Good morning. I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. One of my favorite destinations in the San Gabriel Mountains is the old Vedder Mountain Lookout. I first visited the lookout on a trip to Los Angeles 10 years ago, and it became a frequent return destination for me for a quick day trip into the medium elevations of the San Gabriel Range in the Angeles National Forest. Well, not the tallest peak in the mountain's Front Range area between the Chaparral Zone and the higher montane forest area, at 5,900 feet, Vedder Mountain offers a pretty impressive 360-degree view of the surrounding wilderness, and it was an obvious place for a fire lookout when the Forest Service first built the tower back in 1937. Both the aerial and observatory-dotted summit of Mount Wilson and the peaks of the San Gabriel High Country can all be seen from Vedder Mountain, with the view especially inspiring on winter and spring days when Mount Baldy and Mount Baden-Powell and the high peaks of the San Gabriels wear brilliant crowns of snow. The area around Vedder, the meadows, the streams, including the Charlton Flats picnic area, is a world away from the second largest city in the U.S., a world away from cell phones, city life, cable TV, stress, mortgages, all in less than 45 minutes driving time. The sound of the wind in the pines. Unfortunately, I will never be at the Vedder Mountain Lookout again. In fact, none of us will, because the Vedder Mountain Lookout, Charlton Flats, and dozens of other prized forest and wild destinations in the San Gabriels are gone. Casualties of the station fire in the Angeles National Forest. Early on in the station fire's history, the blaze also took a fatal turn when it took the lives of two Los Angeles County firefighters. The loss of those two men is simply incalculable. And it's become something of a repeat story, played out nearly every year in Southern California, not even in the fall, at the end of summer, on into winter, as a 12-year drought continues to leave the region parched. And all too frequent fires burn away the native ecosystems of Southern California far more quickly than Mother Nature can replenish it. In place of the native ecosystems and plant communities come the true aliens of Southern California, non-native grasses and aggressive, predatory interlopers, which may thrive in the short term, but are also more susceptible to fire themselves and, in the process, snuff out areas for native plants to regain footholds. Well, joining us to talk more about the native chaparral ecosystems of Southern California, as well as a lot of the ecological losses endured in the station fire and other fires, is our good friend from the California Chaparral Institute in Escondido and the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum. He's the author of Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California, now in its second edition, Rick Halsey. And Rick, as always, great to see you. Obviously, I think we all wish this was under better circumstances, yes. But it's nice to have you here again.
Hi, Tommy.
So there's a part of me which believes things could have been even worse with the station fire. And now that we're back in fire season, if that's the right way to put it, I'm concerned about what areas we may lose this year.
It's really impossible to tell because it's going to depend on the weather, which seems to be getting drier and drier and drier as we go forward here. So that's really the determining factor. And you'll see newspaper articles from time to time talking about certain areas that they predict are going to burn next because it's got supposedly unnatural amounts of vegetation, that kind of thing. And for the most part, what we need to be concerned with, not so much is where the older vegetation is, but where the homes are so we can protect the residents and not put firefighters in jeopardy.
Now, we always hear about defensible space, and I know you and I have talked about that before. And one of the things that you've pointed out before was defensible space does not necessarily mean scraping the landscape of every living thing around your home. It means you want to keep some native plants there in some ways to sort of catch the embers as they come towards your home.
Well, exactly. In the 07 fires, there were homes in Rancho Bernardo in San Diego County here that burned an hour before the fire front even got there. And that's because the embers traveled 3 miles ahead of the fire front. And they didn't land in native vegetation. They landed in people's backyards, and they ignited homes within the center of these suburban communities. And the majority of the homes in the Witch Fire, which burned, I think, about 1,300 homes, the majority of those homes were ignited by embers. So it's just not about the vegetation around the communities. It's about these embers that can travel for miles. And when people scrape the landscape, like you've mentioned, all you're really doing is creating bowling alleys for embers to go right straight toward the house and the yard junk and the patio furniture and whatnot. And it's a concept people just don't understand, because so much energy has been placed on vegetation management and very little has been focused on helping people understand it's not just the vegetation, the native vegetation. It's the ornamental vegetation, like your palm trees, your acacias, the low-growing type, the yard junk, the stack of wood, that kind of thing.
These are such common things found in Southern California suburban areas. I mean, palm trees, folks think these are native to Southern California, and they're not.
Yeah, the Mexican fan palms are the worst. The queen palms and things like that are a little less messy, and they're tolerable. But these Mexican fan palms, the fronds that hang off those edges there, they take off and fire and can travel a mile like a burning dinner plate and slam into doors and windows and underneath garage doors, and they take out homes all the time. In the Witch Fire, again, we saw a lot of weird situations where, for example, the little weep screen that's right at the ground level almost, maybe a couple inches above, in between the stucco and the foundation, there's that little maybe inch wide screen. And the bark of the ornamental material that's around the house ignited, and it got up underneath that weep screen. And a couple of firefighters had gone by a house, I believe it was in Rancho Bernardo or maybe Rancho Santa Fe, and the wall of the building was changing as they were watching it. What had happened was the fire had gone into that little weep screen and gone inside the wall, and it was burning from the inside. And so there's an example of a situation where you wouldn't have expected that, but that's what happens. Fire will exploit the weakest link.
And also eucalyptus trees, and I think the danger with those has been known for a long time. They were certainly demonstrated in 1991 in the Oakland Hills fires.
Right. Well, here's the trick. Eucalyptus trees, pine trees, any tree are actually quite fine if they're managed properly. And in fact, if you have these kinds of trees, any kind of tree near your home and it's properly maintained and it's adequately irrigated, it actually creates an ember barrier and a heat sink for the oncoming flame from it. It can protect your home. What happens, though, unfortunately, is a lot of people allow the pine trees and the eucalyptus trees to accumulate junk and debris, and that's where the problem comes in. And so the eucalyptus isn't that bad if it's properly taken care of, but it gets its bad name because of the junk it eventually accumulates. And there's hundreds of kinds of euc, so they're not all in that category.
You were recently featured in a terrific article in the Los Angeles Times about the station fire and what's been lost so far. Can you talk about some of the ecosystems affected in the San Gabriels and why those areas found such a great home in the San Gabriel Mountains?
The fire, the station fire in the San Gabriels was really tragic, and I'll tell you why. About 25% of the area burned hadn't burned since the 1910s. And what that means is there was incredibly beautiful old-growth chaparral. There were some big cone Douglas firs that were in there, which is a remarkable tree. It looks like, if you look at it from Google Earth, if you look down on the forest, unfortunately, the Google Earth still has the images of the forest up there before it was burned. They look like little star patterns. That's how you can distinguish them from overhead. And so what's happened is we've lost a huge amount of beautiful old-growth material that it's going to take generations, again, to recover. And it's not just the forest. The majority of this landscape that burned was chaparral. And you keep hearing about the forest fire, all the trees that were lost. But for the most part, what was really sad to see was some of these huge manzanitas that were destroyed in the chaparral, these shrubs that have trunks about the size of your waist and maybe 20 feet tall. They take generations to grow. And so the tragedy there is just incalculable.
Your old stomping grounds in Santa Barbara, I know, have taken a real beating this past year. 4 major wildfires, if I'm not mistaken, in Santa Barbara County alone just this year. And a couple of them even became urban fires, especially with the one in Montecito.
Right. The Jacinta fire and the Gap fire, all of these fires, one after the other, they've been coming along. And what was interesting was in the fire that came through Santa Barbara, again, it was fueled primarily by urban fuels. It started in the wildland, but once it got into the community, there is so much stuff in that community, palm trees again, house junk, that kind of thing. That's what carried the fire through the community, and that's why a lot of homes were lost. And what people need to realize is the default response is to blame the wildlands or natural areas. And what really can happen in a logical manner is to create these communities within themselves that can withstand a wildland fire and not allow it to get into the community by properly maintaining their own community and the vegetation there, the ornamentals and that kind of thing. And a lot of homes were taken down just because they had the wrong kinds of plants around their houses, or embers came through garage door openings. And one thing that was kind of interesting, there was a house in the Jacinta fire, I think, that was portrayed as this incredibly perfect fire-safe home, and it was featured in CBS News. Well, it almost burned to the ground because, again, embers skipped over the bare ground that was around the house. And fortunately, there was an engine there, and they put it out, so it wasn't totally destroyed. But here again, fire is going to exploit the most weakest link, and people need to understand that.
Often in the wake of these fires, there's almost, we were talking off air, a three-headed monster response that comes in the wake of these fires. the environmental laws, if you want to call them that, are somehow to blame, and that these fires are unnaturally intense, and then a need to sort of go back and reseed and replant. Can you talk about these facets?
Sure. Well, right in the middle of the station fire, there was an AP Associated Press article that came out, and it was headlined saying, "Feds fail to clear brush in the LA wildfire area." And the lead article paragraph here was talking about how the feds failed to follow through on their plans to burn away highly flammable brush in the forest at the edge of the Angeles Forest to avoid the very kind of fire now raging. And the whole article implies that if the federal government, the U.S. Forest Service, the Fire Service, had properly cleared the vegetation, this fire wouldn't have happened. This is really poor journalism, and it's sensationalism in its most profane form. There were about 1,700 acres of prescribed burns that had been planned, and they had not been able to do about 80% of those because the window of doing those things is very, very tight. Prescribed burns are not easy. They get out of control sometimes. So the Forest Service is doing the best it could to do these fuel treatments, they call them. And the fact that this fire spread so quickly and started in the first place had nothing to do with any of these fuel breaks or any of these fuel treatments. It wouldn't have stopped anything. And that's not even reflected properly in this article. So people picked this up, and it was cancerous. It spread across the internet pretty quickly. And one of the comments in the article says that calls to the Sierra Club for comment were not immediately returned. Well, what does that mean? That means, well, these environmentalists are preventing the Forest Service or whoever from doing these prescribed burns, and consequently, it's the environmental laws or the environmentalists. Somebody's to blame for these fires. And what people have got to understand is these fires, these huge fires, are inevitable in Southern California. It doesn't matter what we do. What we can do is create communities that are fire safe and let the fires burn and not start blaming people for an environment that's inherently flammable.
Well, this is the United States, and we like a scapegoat.
Yes, it does.
Someone has to be at fault because I have to go sue somebody here at the end of the day.
Well, that's exactly it. And then, of course, the Forest Service tries to react to these things, and one of the things they do is they try to do litigation mitigation, I like to call it, where they'll spray a lot of mulch or replant or do something after fire because people can't stand the black slopes. And all that generally does is disturb the ecosystem doubly, and I just read an article recently here that they're going to reforest. There's a group up in LA that wants to reforest the burned areas. Well, the system can recover on its own. That's what it's geared to do. And when you go in there and start to replant things, all you're going to end up is disturbing the system. And sometimes there might be areas where replanting is acceptable. But for the most part, you got to just leave these systems alone.
So replanting in some cases is appropriate, but do you feel that replanting is sometimes often used as a photo op or just some public relations?
Well, sure. It's something to make people feel better, and that's what this is all about. And the scientific community is pretty clear on this. All those kinds of mitigation techniques that are tried to make things look better, or they used to do a lot of seeding, and finally we've gotten away from that. But it really is a waste of taxpayer money. It would be better used in terms of trying to educate people how to deal with a fire-prone environment, retrofit their homes. And this notion that the station fire was horribly and naturally intense and shouldn't have happened in the first place. And, you know, the chaparral ecosystem, which was the majority of the system that burned up in this fire, You've got to have hot, intense, huge fires for the system to recover. The hotter the fire, the better. And this is really strange to hear because you're thinking, that sounds so odd. That's a forest mentality. This wasn't primarily a forest that burned. It was chaparral. And those plants and ecosystem patterns, they need these hot fires to nuke out, in a sense, the non-native seeds that may be there and to stimulate the native seeds to germinate.
So applying this whole idea of Rocky Mountain or Pacific Northwest forestry to our ecosystem in Southern California, simply, it is not applicable.
Well, it's insane. And the fundamental problem we have is that the Angeles National Forest is called the Angeles National Forest. It's not a forest. There's some beautiful trees, no doubt, up there. But the majority of that forest is chaparral. It should be called the National Chaparral Recreation Area. And then finally people will say, oh, it's not a forest fire, it's a chaparral fire. Okay, now we can start talking. And now we can start realizing the system we're dealing with and then get back to reality and stop thinking we're in the Rocky Mountains.
Now, as far as the receding thing goes, replanting.
Yes.
What always gets discussed whenever these fires happen is come the rainy season, we're going to have big mud flows and mudslides. And if you're in La Cañada Flint Ridge, I mean, that's a reasonable concern.
It is. And really, there's a couple things that you can do. You can put check dams in these canyons. You can do some straw bales, which may divert some water. But when the big storms come, basically what you have to do is open up your back door and let the mud go through the living room and come out the front door. I mean, that's really sometimes the only thing you can do because erosion happens. And there's certain things we can do, but trying to mulch the area and seed it is really counterproductive. And we all know, like the Waterman Canyon disaster that happened after the 03 fires, it was horrible. Huge boulders the size of Volkswagens came coming. You can't stop that kind of a thing. So how do you mitigate it? Well, you stop building in these areas that are prone to that. And if you do build there, understand the risks. And don't expect the government or someone to fix the problem because you just can't.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Helm, and joining us is Rick Halsey, the founder and director of the California Chaparral Institute and a member of the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum. Now, for more on the California Chaparral Institute, go to their website, www.californiachaparral.com. That's californiachaparral.com. Great website, outstanding information, lots of interesting and enlightening reading. Check it out, californiachaparral.com, and chaparral spelled with one P. And two R's.
Two R's, right.
One P and two R's. Rick is also the author of Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California. That's now in its second edition, correct?
Right, just the second one came out last year.
Now, you've been at loggerheads, if that's safe to say, with the San Diego County Board of Supervisors the past year or so.
I think that's accurate, yes.
Over the issue of what's described as brush clearing, and we kind of touched on that. Can you talk about really what's been going on this past year?
The bottom line is, when I went into this whole issue and tried to help the Board of Supervisors understand what was going on, I was naive enough to think that if you just present the data, everybody will say, well, gee, Rick, that's great. We understand now. But that isn't the way it works. There's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of egos involved. And basically what's happened is San Diego County, the voters and the Board of Supervisors, no one's willing to pay or show the leadership needed to create a properly funded fire protection system in this county. This county is arguably one of the most fire-prone environments in California. Yet we spend less on fire than any other comparable county. Not even less, but multiple times less. And so to make up for that, what the county has done is try to get federal grants to do these vegetation treatment projects. And there's definitely a need for vegetation treatments around homes and communities. But what will happen is they got a $7 million grant here recently to do two things. One, to help people create defensible space around their homes, which is great. And two, to clear some of the trees 300 feet beyond evacuation areas and structures, et cetera. Okay, now just think about that on Palomar Mountain. 300 feet is about the size of a football field. There's a lot of houses and roads. You could effectively have a house 600 feet from the road, and that whole area, that 600 feet, two football fields, would be a zone where you would take out those trees. So you've got effectively an area on Palomar Mountain because of this grant and the way the thing is written, you could clear huge amounts of areas of trees that they deem either dead or diseased or whatever. And what we're asking them to do is just stop a minute, do a proper environmental assessment, figure out what you really need to do, what's the best way to protect lives and property up there, not just going in and deciding, oh, let's take this tree out, this tree out. Do a plan. And this county has consistently failed to plan for anything. That's why this Prop 1A failed. I mean, they just said, give us the money, we'll figure out to do it. No, you develop a plan, you have the leadership to explain to the voters, here's what we're going to do with your money, and if you vote for it, here's what's going to happen. They never did that. This is the same thing. They want to accept the $7 million, and they just want to say, trust us, we're going to do what we want to do. Well, no, that doesn't work. The county needs to go through the proper planning process. It needs to have the community be able to provide input. They need to listen to them, and that needs to be part of the process. And so our institute is suing the county to force them to go through the California Environmental Quality Act in order for them to listen to the public, to plan out what they're going to do, and at the very minimum, to make sure they don't spread this oak beetle that's killing hundreds of oaks in the backcountry. I mean, what are they going to do with that? It's not in the plan at the moment because there is no plan. So that's one of the issues we want to make sure they focus on.
Now, Prop 1A, that was to create a county fire department, like most of the counties in the state have?
No, it was to put a parcel tax on people's homes and businesses. I forget exactly what it was. I think it was $50. And that was it. There was no plan what they were going to do with the money. They said they were going to do it for fire protection. Okay, well, what were you going to buy engines? And where were those engines going to go? This is an issue that we've been battling with them for years. If you're going to ask people for money, you're obligated to tell them what you're going to do with it. And they never did. And that's why a lot of firefighters and myself included didn't support the proposition, because it was just another waste of taxpayer money without any kind of representation at all.
The Blue Ribbon Commission, several years ago after the 2003 fires, recommended, more than recommended, really almost demanded,
right,
that the county get busy and get additional fire engines.
Right.
And what happens now, it seems, is that once in a while, the county will make a deal with, I think, Sequan, and they'll get a helicopter, and we'll get to see it on television, and it winds up being this cool TV piece, and here was what we're doing to fight fires. We have a helicopter. And that's nice, but you need additional fire engines as well.
During both the Cedar Fire and the 07 fires, San Diego City itself had like a couple engines in the city during the fire left. You call, your father has a heart attack, there's nobody that's going to show up because they're all out fighting the county's fires. This is inexcusable. It's just inexcusable. And I don't know why people aren't marching in the streets, frankly. The Blue Ribbon Commission recommended after the 03s and the 07 fires that 180X engines should be bought for the California system down here, and not just San Diego County. And I think 18 or so have been purchased. And that's been, what, 6-7 years?
I mean,
that's just ridiculous. I mean, I know the budgets are tight, but if we do have a big earthquake or a flood or whatever, the fire service and the emergency response system in this state is not going to be able to adequately respond because they don't have the personnel, they don't have the equipment, and San Diego County is the worst of all of them.
Yeah, it's getting to the point where other counties may not reciprocate if we have a major incident down here.
Well, yes, and it's happening right now. There was a fire up north where San Francisco, who is very willing to send engines out on what we call a mutual aid kind of program to other departments, and they didn't send any because they had to take care of their own people. And as more and more budget cuts occur, what's going to happen is the next big fire down here, Orange County is going to say, no, we're not sending anybody down there because we're at risk too. And they have a right to say that. They have to protect their own citizens. And so the chicken's going to come roost here pretty quickly if there's another big disaster, and I hope there isn't. But if there is, maybe at that point, the public will finally get the message that you've got to be able to pay for the system to protect you. And that's the number one job of government, is to protect the life and safety of its citizens. I think the public's pretty intelligent in the long run. And I think if the leadership, if someone could show some for a change in this county and would explain to them, here's what we have. And don't use dramatic statements about how there's going to be a fire and it's going to destroy the county. And, you know, just lay it out. Look, folks, we live in a fire-prone environment. It's a beautiful ecosystem, chaparral and forests, but we're going to have fires, and it's part of our life. And we've got to be able to figure out a way to pay for the protection that we need if we want to live here safely. And here's how we're suggesting you do it. And you get on the radio. How many supervisors have come here and talked about their plan to protect the county? Probably none, I wouldn't imagine.
I could probably do a better job of outreach to them for...
Well, that's true, but...
To be fair.
I mean, all of us could, but there just isn't an effort to make the program viable so that people will vote for it. And I think once that happens, I think people say, okay, I acknowledge that, and they'll vote for it. That's an estimation. I don't know. I mean, I can't predict the future, but I've got to believe that people are a little more intelligent than we give them credit for sometimes.
You know, real quickly, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you about this because I've been talking about this a lot this summer. This year, we've seen the threatened closure of, first, 220 of California's 279 state parks. That was then revised to 100 of California's 279 state parks. Now the governor's apparently going back and reconsidering the idea altogether in light of how little money the state's going to save at the end of the day by closing these parks at all. And while I'm glad to see the number of proposed park closures going down, and I'm aware we're going to lose some, what does this talk of park closures say to you?
Well, in our busy lives, there are very rare opportunities for us to enjoy the natural environment, and there's been lots of studies indicating, and I'm sure everyone's probably heard one or two of those, that explain the benefits of having a place where you can go and enjoy the natural environment. And it's really critical for mental health and just a multitude of issues. And to close the very places that we can go to take down the stress, to go run, to go have a picnic, just seems to be so crazy. I mean, in the short term, I guess it would make sense. Sure, just slice all this stuff. But this isn't a short-term issue. You close these parks, it has huge, major, long-term implications. You fire people who are institutions, who have a knowledge base of the ecosystems in which these parks are protecting. They're not probably going to come back after you fire them in 2 or 3 years. You're going to find those people again? Probably not. And the huge number of businesses that depend on these parks that have all sorts of contracts to help the public enjoy the parks more. And you have families that have depended on these places for generations. And I don't think the governor and the folks that have advocated this really understand what they're talking about, because maybe they haven't had a chance to go to the parks or they're locked in an office too long. And that maybe is a testimony to why they ought to get outside, because once you do, you begin to appreciate the environment in a way that would make you think this kind of idea is ridiculous. I think there was just a bill passed, I don't know whether the governor signed it or not, that will protect parks from being used as infrastructure foundations for freeways and tunnels and wires. Because what people have to realize is, you know, you can fight these battles over and over, but once you lose one of them, that resource is gone forever. There's no going back. And folks need to understand, this is not about how we're going to save jobs and make money and get the economy rolling. It's about protecting a resource that needs to be there forever. And the minute you start compromising it, it's gone. And there's no replacement for it. And that's an issue people need to really take to heart and understand. It's long-term versus short-term, which unfortunately, I think we have a heck of a time understanding. I was at a Senate hearing yesterday, and over the whole issue about fire and are we losing the battle against fire and that kind of thing. And the Cal Fire and a lot of folks were testified, and they did a pretty good job explaining the need for financial support for more engines, more personnel. But there were a couple of citizens that came up, and what they indicated was they didn't understand. There's this huge mass of vegetation from the mountains all the way to the beach. Can't we lay like fuel breaks in or start cutting it up or something? First of all, people need to understand fuel breaks, cutting up these resources, it's not going to work. It's not going to stop fires. All it's going to end up in the long run doing is destroying the natural resources that we all enjoy. For example, there's 10,000 acres of fuel treatments in the Angeles National Forest that were burned over in the Station Fire, and there's 160 miles of fuel breaks in there. How many more do you want? Yeah. And so the point is, again, what are you afraid of? You're afraid of losing your life and your home. Well, then do something about your home and your community to keep the fire from coming in there. And understand, if it's a tree, if it's a shrub, or if it's a weed, it's going to carry a fire. And there was a fire in Texas and Oklahoma in 06, 05 or so. 3 million acres and a dozen people died. It was a grass fire. The only brush that burned, I think, was in somebody's bathroom. So people need to understand these fires are going to burn here regardless. And by going out on the landscape and doing massive prescribed burns or grinding up huge tracks to make fuel breaks, it's not going to work. What's going to work is protecting the communities in themselves, creating safety zones for firefighters, putting some fuel breaks in strategic areas, but small ones, and just back away from trying to figure out we can force nature to adapt to us, because it's not going to work. We have to adapt to nature, and that's the only long-term successful solution in enjoying life in Southern California.
Rick Halsey, as usual, it is always outstanding to have you on this program.
Thanks.
It's great to see you. Rick Halsey is the founder and director of the California Chaparral Institute, also a member of the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum. Website, once again, for the California Chaparral Institute, californiachaparral.com. If you haven't picked it up yet, check out the second edition of Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California. Rick, good luck with all of your endeavors.
Thank you.
And we will see you next time, pal.
Enjoy the chaparral.
That's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe. Again, thanks to Rick Halsey from the California Chaparral Institute. And Chaparral, lest we forget, one P, two R's. Chaparral spelled C-H-A-P-A-R-R-A-L. His website, www.californiachaparral.com. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media, and as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. For more information on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, you can go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM 94.9 website. That's www.fm949sd.com. Tree Huggers International will also be resuming operation at treehuggersintl.com. That's treehuggersintl.com. This is Tommy Howe for Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9. We'll be back again next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. But in the meantime, get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation next on FM 94.9. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.